Hey folks, welcome to the show. Hey Sharad Tupran, how's it going, man?
But I'm looking forward to today's chat because I think after a lot of companies and founders, we've got someone who's slightly on our side of the fence.
Yes, that's true. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Shivam Bajaj, founder and CEO of Avener Capital. Hey Shivam, how's it going, man?
Hey Nikhil, hey Sharad, thanks. Thank you guys for having me.
You know, this is we usually record at around 3 p.m. This is, I think, one of the first episodes that we are recording at around 6-ish. 3 p.m. is usually on a Friday. It's 3 p.m. is usually a post-lunch podcast where, you know, there's a lot of pressure on the host to keep the chat interesting because, you know, we are all kind of a bit, I would say, droopy-eyed. But with 6 p.m., I think there's that pressure kind of goes off. Great. No, Shivam, I think as Sharad briefly alluded to, we are a bit on the similar side, but I think it would be great if you can give a very short overview about what you guys are doing, you know, to bring some context.
So I think, yeah, like Sharad mentioned, I think Avener Capital is a better financial advisory firm, and, you know, our focus has always been to advise clients, provide them with strategic, unconflicted advice, and to, of course, help them raise capital. We typically operate, you know, in two key spaces or two key verticals. One is our focus on real assets, where we typically work with companies in the infrastructure domain, you know, be it transportation, energy, transmission, you know, potentially education, and help them raise capital. You know, that's really our core business. You know, more recently, I would say 12 to 18 months ago, we decided to start another vertical, which is the emerging clients vertical.
Right.
Wherein we want to work with companies that are young and fast growing and help them raise capital effectively. So we do some primaries, we do secondaries, and we do round extensions, you know, in the emerging clients division.
Yeah. And do you guys take position yourself as well sometimes, like sort of come in and, partake in the issue, or sort of strictly take an advisory role?
It's strictly an advisory business, an advisory business. I think our family office operates through different parameters, but we usually keep that separate from the advisory business.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because what have you been seeing sort of in the last 12 months, you know, because the reason there's just so many narratives that have come up, right? I mean, since, COVID is now totally dated, but after that, the whole Ukraine, Russia, inflation rising, they were talking about winter, you know, capital is drying out from the Indian startup ecosystem. What have you generally seen, if, you know, the theme in the last 12 months? And we can share a little bit from our side as well. I mean, we did see D2C companies struggle a little bit to raise capital. We did see CACs go up. We did see a little bit of dry up in capital. But, you know, get sort of mixed signals. What is something that you've been seeing, and you can say that that's been a key theme that you've seen in the last 12 months or so?
See, I think, you know, if I look back from COVID, you know, when liquidity was easily available, I think most fund managers and most aspiring fund managers also, you know, became VCs and PEs, right? And I think the amount of capital availability and dry powder that was available in the ecosystem continued to be at an all-time high.
Yeah.
And I think the amount of dry powder, even in today's you know, market scenario, continues to be at relatively high levels, at least in India. I think most fund managers, of course, now on the investment side, you know, some have sort of, you know, kept a lot of this capital or the dry powder earmarked for their existing portfolio companies.
Yeah.
Till, you know, the existing portfolio companies are able to reach profitability or become EBITDA break-even. Because till then, they may need to keep redeploying capital, you know, into the existing positions that they may have taken. And hence, they have relatively slowed down the pace on new deployment. That being said, I think, you know, there are certain pockets that continue to attract capital and that continue to get funded. I think if I were to look at from the entrepreneur side, I see a lot of change in the mindset of entrepreneurs in general. I think entrepreneurs now are focusing on EBITDA break-even profitability. I think you know, they're thinking of their business much more rationally. You know, a lot of layoffs are also happening, which I think is good for the ecosystem because a lot of unnecessary costs are being effectively chopped down. So you're seeing businesses turn into real businesses effectively. So I think some of this cleanup is good.
It's not just selling on MAU growth and top line growth and engagement, but also show some cash flow generation and profitability, right? I
mean, absolutely. They say, right, like as you have to keep cleaning your cupboard from time to time and keep sort of taking out all the unnecessary items, I think the cleanup within the VC ecosystem and on the entrepreneur side is good and healthy.
You know, I mean, it also kind of shows the difference in mindset from the standpoint of staging, right? I mean, like you, through your work, I think have an interesting vantage point. You look at mid-market companies, you look at businesses which are backed by real hard assets. But on the other end, you're also looking at probably tech-centric or tech-enabled startups, right? So you are looking at a mix of both traditional businesses as well as new age companies. And as a result of that, when you must be marketing those businesses, you also have a different vantage point when it comes to VCs versus PEs. I mean, what I think we are all noticing is that for PE funds, EBITDA or cash flow generation was always the starting point, right? They probably would not be very impressed solely by operational metrics or top line. Whereas now VCs are thinking a bit more like funds. Maybe it's an indication of risk off. Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether it's a fundamental change in their DNA or it's just a function of a lot of them, burning their fingers and hence using cash flow generation as a quote unquote pushback to a lot of the businesses that come there. And probably that is percolating into how founders are also thinking, especially for early stage companies.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I would completely agree, Nikhil. I think if I sort of look at the VC landscape, and I think, some of the VCs previously preferred higher cash burning companies.
Yes.
Because it gave them a chance for higher deployment into those companies, right? At the end of the day, venture capital is also a business where, VC funds also themselves own a 220 carry structure, So venture capital is also a business at the end of it. And I think VC funds are also keen to deploy more capital, to deploy capital quickly and then look to raise a fresh fund, right? So I think the focus has always, of course, been, on more rampant exponential growth.
Yes.
Then a feeling that the unit cannot play out over a period of time, right? In the capital markets particularly, these new age businesses tried to click and did get some early success in the capital markets. But I think once interest rates started going up, these new age businesses were the first ones to correct, right? Because I think in India, I think the retail investors, domestic capital continues to prefer businesses that are profitable, rather than get enticed purely by growth, right? Growth, of course, being an important metric, but I think profitability being really important for the domestic investors.
But isn't that anyways an expectation which one has from a listed company?
Absolutely. So I think that depth, in the capital markets, like how you have the NASDAQ in the US, for example, where you have tech companies, getting listed and appreciated by the market. I think in India, that hasn't deepened as yet, because I think the focus has always been profitability. So I think VC funds also have realized the importance of the unit economics actually playing out, profitability taking place, because that's when their exit would effectively fructify. Right? So I think would most certainly see a trend among, VC funds where the total addressable market continues to be a key parameter, but they will also continue to guide their portfolio companies toward creating more sustainable businesses.
Right. And exit, like speaking of exit, naturally, IPO or listing is often the end point. But it was also because for at least in the first or second wave of startups which emerged in India, secondary is something that had still not kicked off. Whereas in the last 2 to 3 years, the secondary exit market of, you know, someone buying you out before you actually get listed, that has, I think, also, I mean, I'm not very sure whether it is an equitable, range of exits. I think there are some specific businesses or some more high profile transactions or, you know, or which have been heavily funded. They have seen secondary exits before the listing event comes into the picture. So I don't think it's structural yet, right? But probably that also is a new reality, right? For for a lot of the funds which are coming in as we speak.
No, I think there are some great secondary market opportunities available in the market, right? When I say secondary market, I mean the private market secondaries available in the market, right? I think there are some great opportunities available. And, you know, I think interesting pools of capital, you know, coming up now, to absorb those secondaries. So our sense is that over the next, 12 to 24 months, you might have a lot of funds who are secondary focused funds. And their objective is purely to clean up cap tables and provide, some of the existing investors or employees, ESOP pools, some kind of liquidity, especially when, capital becomes relatively more scarce. So, personally, expect the secondary market to most certainly continue deepening.
Mm-hmm.
And
are you seeing any change on the credit side of things? Historically, I mean, we are still a capital-starved economy, largely when it comes to especially small-scale businesses. But, we saw like a wave of fintechs which focused on retail credit. I mean, that sort of became like a big play. Now, sort of those NBFCs are sort of going beyond, and there's a play to sort of look at SME type funding as well, working capital financing or invoice discounting and things like that. There is a shift on how debt has been historically perceived. But are you seeing that at a company level, like people open to raise, work towards a capital structure optimization, mix it with equity debt? If there is no equity, then sort of look at debt. And listen, I mean, can't really compare to the Western world because of higher pricing in India, but generally, is there a change in appetite of looking at some kind of debt structure, maybe for companies which are fairly well funded on the equity side?
I think there's a lot of appetite for debt. I think today most companies are looking for debt solutions rather than equity, especially because investors on the equity side have become very value cognizant, right? Mm-hmm. So I think most entrepreneurs are trying to find some kind of debt solutions. And that's why there's been a lot of robust growth in the RBFs, in some of these revenue-based financiers, in alternative debt funds, credit debt funds.
Yeah.
So most certainly see that I think till markets ease out further, debt continues to be a preferred option for most founders. Rather than potential dilution in tougher markets.
But, speaking of RBFs, it's very interesting that you mentioned because, a lot of times the way RBFs are sold is that it's a, very cash flow based underwriting and a structured solution where maybe, the principal or the interest repayments are backloaded. But often the way they transpire in real world is they have very vanilla rigid structures, pretty much EMI style. The repayments are front loaded. Pricing is fairly high. Like it's pretty common to look at like 25% plus IRRs,
yeah.
Right? And that way it, and I mean, often, and obviously they have a preference for more digitally enabled businesses, right? I mean, like to tap any traditional, a traditional business or some sort of a manufacturing unit that just doesn't interest them at the end of the day. So those guys, if they don't, they will like, they have a typical route, right? And we have seen it. They will first look at the 2 crore unsecured government guaranteed limit. Once that maxes out, you know, they would either go the informal route or the promoters will just leverage themselves personally and whatnot. I think that's the that's the playbook, right? So when it, what do you think is the constraint when it comes to cash flow based underwriting? I mean, most of the SMEs, especially I'm not saying large corporate, or I'm not even saying medium size. I'm saying guys, you know, who are sub 100 or sub 150 crore turnover businesses, they are asset light at the end of the day. They don't have a lot of pool to collateralize, right? So, I mean, secured financing can only take them a certain way. What do you think is a constraint from an underwriter standpoint to do like real structured cash flow based, you know, financing? For such businesses, is it because a lot of the businesses are doing, like a lot of business happens off books through cash? That's a problem. Is it you know, reporting? Is that an issue? You know, lack of credit history. That's the issue. What do you think is the pain point from a lender standpoint?
So, actually, from a lender standpoint, it really becomes you know, I think most lenders initially. I think when lenders appraise credit, I think there are two key factors for them to appraise credit. One is, of course, ability to pay, and the second is willingness to pay. I think if we look at the ability to pay, right, I think more often than not, you know, revenue-based financiers get comfortable by when they look at the financials and the ability of the company to pay. But I think, you know, to get further comfort on the willingness, I think one does need to build a track record with a certain client and, you know, get comfort over a period of time with that client in order to scale the relationship. So I think I see it as a more gradual process. And the biggest challenge, you know, from a revenue-based financier or some of these alternative debt financiers really becomes, you know, sort of scaling that relationship over a period of time, right? Because there are certain clients who might be, you know, good customers, but you know, they might have only one-time small requirement. They might not really need that capital. There are some who tend to borrow more often, which of course, you know, becomes a good constant recurring line for a lot of the revenue-based financiers. But I think more often it really becomes you know, establishing the willingness to pay.
Right.
But
that part, unfortunately, I think cannot be, it's difficult to visualize that as a feature-based lending kind of a paradigm, right? To actually ascertain the willingness to pay. That automatically becomes the a very traditional way of underwriting in the first place.
Absolutely.
Which is,
because see, what happens, right, is that typically you can't create a charge on cash flows exclusively, right? Because a lot of times, you know, these companies will have some senior lenders sitting there, you know, who might have a charge on all the current assets or on the working capital, right, for example. Yeah. And then to create any fresh charge, you know, onto an escrow, usually I'll require a lender NOC.
Yeah.
Now take, for example, if I need to go to a lender and get a an NOC, it becomes a very cumbersome process when the whole objective of a revenue-based financier is effectively to give credit fast, right? So I'm ultimately taking an unsecured call on the ability of a borrower to pay, which becomes relatively straightforward for me to take. But the call that really becomes difficult for me to take because I don't have a robust security structure is tomorrow, even if the client you know, does have money, how do I ensure that he pays me, right? And that really comes down to the willingness which I was speaking about.
Yeah. The other the thought is you price that in. I mean, there's a reason we jack up to 40% plus IRRs, right? I mean, we can go to as high as 40% IRRs. I mean, you sort of price that in and take that bet. But we've seen that. I mean, we've invested and we've underwritten also from our own prop book to, you know, to offer some capital financing. And so, but I think as well, and the reason we can do that is, we are much more bespoke, and we sort of have an advisory angle. We understand the predictability and confidence of the future cash flow. So you can still do that at a granular, you know, hand-picked deal. But to sort of scale it up, it becomes a challenge because it's hard to capture that willingness. And if the willingness is there, and if everything is there, then traditional banks also would step in. So it's a very interesting spot. And I mean, we're speaking about debt, but I also wanted to sort of ask you about, I think you guys or you have worked a fair bit on the REIT side, which is...
InvITs side, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Which is InvITs and yeah, which is an interesting asset class.
Sharad loves REIT. He comes from the land of REITs.
Canada is probably the most crowded yield trade in the world when it comes to dividend stocks and REITs and InvITs. And even the Western economy, I think about 70-75% of real estate is listed is via REITs. It's in emerging markets are like sub 10%. So there's obviously, I'm very careful to make a comment saying, oh, West is at 70, so we have a long runway because we are still at 10, because it need not always play like that. Every economy may have differently, but there is still room. I mean, the thesis that has been sold to us for the last few years, there are what, 3 or 4 REITs right now. And two of them are Canadian. I think Brookfield is one, and IMBC, BlackRock. These guys are there. But what do you think has it been satisfactory in terms of the way it's sort of tracked, and just some thoughts from your end on REITs, because it's a very specialized.
Also, market. I think there was some negative commentary recently post budget with the taxation hitting REITs. Would love hear your thoughts on that as well. Huh?
No, absolutely. I think it's a very interesting, topic, and one, of course, very close to me. I would club InvITs and REITs and hybrid securities effectively. So, we'll club them under one basket. I think overall, InvIT and REIT market in India has performed well, I would say. I would say that there have been a lot of issuances if I were to club InvITs and REITs together, and if I look at the size of each of the issuance, it's been on an average at least $1 billion. So I think a good amount of capital coming to InvITs and REITs, I think, capital exceeding, maybe a lakh crores of equity funding, which has ultimately, predominantly gone to either growth capital as equity, into under construction projects, to free them up for capital effectively, or it's gone to, prepay banks. So I would say overall, if I were to look at the landscape of REITs and InvITs in general, I think there's been a lot of interest. I would say practically some of the largest asset managers globally, sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, they all have exposure to InvITs and REITs. These are your Canadians, your Singaporeans, your European investors. So all the largest, asset managers globally, who have exposure to InvITs and REITs in India. So I think as an asset class, of course, it's performed very well. Of course, there has been a bit of pressure on InvITs and REITs and more new issuances in the last, couple of quarters. And that's largely attributable to a rise in the interest rates. Because internationally, interest rates, have moved up substantively. Domestically, also, there has been a hike. But if you see most of the InvITs and REITs, most of them have been private capital, from asset managers globally, effectively. So I think with the interest rate cycle moving north, globally, of course, fresh issuances have come under a bit of pressure. But most certainly do expect this to ease out. Once interest rates start cooling off, most certainly see a lot more demand and appetite coming into InvITs and REITs again. The regulator has also done a fantastic job, be it SEBI, be it the ministry, to come up with this product. And I see a very, very bright path ahead, for InvITs and REITs in general. I think on the new regulation that you mentioned about, yes, it's unfortunate. I think the payment of capital, where they're planning to tax.
Yeah.
And I think there have been various representations made, to the government, including the Ministry of Finance, and do hope that I think some solution is
solved. And it's interesting because there was a lot of, in mainstream media, there was a lot of comparison and commentary being done on how fractional ownership would become more attractive versus like a REIT or an InvIT. But the problem, I think, is that REITs and InvITs gives liquidity, right? Fractional ownership does not. So, I don't know whether the investors will also take that into account, that effectively, taxation is obviously one criteria, but taxation is not something which is the sole factor when it comes to choosing an asset class.
See, it gives you the diversification benefit, right? I think the biggest advantage with an inbuilt REIT is it gives you a pool, it gives you access to a pool of cap, a pool of assets.
Yeah.
As opposed to in a fractional, you're owning just that one asset, right?
Yeah.
And you're owning a part of that one asset. So tomorrow, basically, if something goes wrong with that asset, something goes wrong, in that particular area, for example, your investment gets impacted. But if you're owning, let's say, units of a REIT,
yes.
That REIT in turn may have, 4, 5, 6, 10 assets, and you get diversified across the cash flows of all those assets.
Because they're tradable. So,
yeah, they're tradable. You have liquidity available with you. Relatively easily. Of course, the taxation benefit also is becomes available. So I think from all these perspectives, personally see a very bright future for InBits and REITs.
But do you think sort of retail participation will also? I mean, the trading lot sizes are quite big, right? I mean, they're not ideal for a retail investor.
See, they've been reduced. I think SEBI has kept them relatively larger because the product is, of course, complex and they want more sophisticated capital to come into the product.
Yeah.
But I have no doubts in my mind that more and more retail are going to participate in this product. I have absolutely no doubts in my mind. And that's simple because today, if I compare FD rates, right? See, ultimately for India to keep growing in the longer term, let's take, for example, 10 years from today, 20 years from today, ultimately inflation has to come down, and interest rates have to cool off, right? India cannot be a market where interest rates will continue to be at, 6-7% in terms of FD rates, right? Let's say 1 or 2 decades later. So I think, of course, interest rates will come down, inflation will come down as our economy continues to mature. And, InBits and REITs can actually give, an alpha generation of, 200-300 basis points over fixed income yields, right? Without much of risk, because most of these InBits REITs are all AAA rated by the parties. So, our sense is that I think the overall retail participation, once people are able to understand and appreciate the product, will increase multifold. I have no doubts about that.
And anyway, I mean, to just close off on REITs, historically, real estate investments in India always carry that shady angle to it. I know one way to sort of remove that shady angle is to list it and have blue chip names associated with it. But I mean, REITs can still, I mean, you need to be what, 80% completed, right? To set up a REIT, I think.
At least 80%.
And in India, if it's not 100%, people are still, are expecting that there is a lot of development and execution risk associated with real estate. It's a trickier sell, I feel, psychologically, because of how historically it's used as an asset class in India. Just go to sort of tier 2, tier 3 cities. I mean, real estate is the ideal vehicle to move money in cash, right? I mean, that's what people see it as. But it's interesting. I mean, I think generally agree with how you're seeing it, that it's a very interesting asset class. And like you said, like a perfect diversification tool for any portfolio manager to sort of
absolutely
equity and debt beautifully. Very interesting.
Do you see, like you mentioned fractionalization, we are also seeing a whole bunch of new age companies which are targeting the problem of fractionalization of financial securities, right? Use blockchain technology to use, in order to make units more divisible, especially in typical illiquid asset classes. Like there are now startups who are focusing exclusively on corporate bonds, because there's always a narrative, right, that the market is not deep enough. Kind of add the layer of fractionalization and basically create a secondary market for something which doesn't really exist as of now by that said fractionalization. When we see those businesses, to be fair, we get very, I mean, though we like that idea, but we feel that there is a lot of regulatory risk, at least there's a lot of regulatory alignment which needs to happen, in order to ensure that, okay, once the technology part is not the biggest issue here, right? The technology part or the commodification of financial securities, that can be done, I'm sure. But to actually bring the regulator on board, to make sure that those units actually have recourse in the court of law, so that if tomorrow, pardon my French, shit hits the fan, you actually can take some piece of paper to someone to show that, here I have my title, etc. And I need to be compensated in what way or whatever fashion. That, I think, is the biggest challenge. In your conversations with your clients and even with the regulator, I'm guessing at some level you guys must be engaged. Yeah. How do you see that pan out? Do you see that more as a medium to long-term play, or do you see that already happen? Like, do you actually see, because RBI is different. RBI is, I think, a bit ahead of the curve when it comes to other regulators.
But
when
it comes to opinion on corporate bonds in India, and according to me, the main reason corporate bonds in India as a market have never picked up is purely because of the taxation. Today, I think if I were to invest in the units of a mutual fund, I would get an indexation benefit plus. I would ultimately get, the benefit of long-term capital, long-term, taxation when I were to exit the units of a mutual fund, right? I think if I were to directly subscribe to INR NCD issued by a corporate, I would ultimately be paying tax as per my tax slab, right? So let's take, for example, I'm in the highest tax bracket slab, you pay as per the highest. If you're a corporate subscribing, you'll pay as per the corporate tax rate, right? Effective corporate tax rate. So that means that, let's take for example, even if I'm subscribing to a AAA NCD paper at maybe 8.5%, my post-tax yield, comes down significantly to almost, 6.25, right? If I look at inflation in India today, inflation in India is almost, in and around that range. So the alpha to inflation, on a post-tax basis, really becomes zero, right? So I think the biggest reason, whereas equities today, the reason the market continues to be so robust is because of the, sort of taxation structure where you have long-term and short-term capital gains, right?
But sorry, Shivam, just one question. For a AAA rated investment of that nature, isn't that same in the Western world as well? Wouldn't it come down post-tax basis very close to the inflation number?
See, I think that's when the spread, right, itself is much thinner, right? I mean, I think the key aspect that I'm talking about, Sharad, here is that today, at the end of it, very few issuers are able to access the bond market, to my mind, because of the taxation structure, right? I mean,
interesting.
Ultimately, I had some rebate on the taxation structure, right? Whereas I was not paying effectively as per my corporate tax slab or as per my individual or corporate tax slab, I would most certainly see much stronger participation in the bond markets, right? Because, take for example, today you buy a 10% paper also, which is a AA paper or a AA minus paper at 10%. Your post-tax return is 7, right? I mean, in that case, I think you will always prefer investing in the blue chip equity stock. As opposed to buying a corporate bond paper, maybe at 10%. Because from a post-tax return perspective, the leakage becomes substantive. You would always prefer as an individual then to subscribe to debt via a mutual fund rather than directly hold debt, right, because of the taxation piece. So at least my personal belief is that, I think for the secondary market to really develop, I think the primary market first needs to develop, which is where I think until and unless there are certain tax incentives or the tax structure on NCD doesn't change, I really don't see retail participation in the bond market ramping up.
Interesting. I mean, from an investor standpoint, I completely agree with you. But, one also kind of looks at things from an issuer standpoint. Obviously you mentioned like AAA rated securities. If you look at G-Secs, themselves, right? I mean, not even corporate. I mean, it's a very small club, right? In terms of primary dealers, large brokers. I mean, it doesn't even, like, retail is so far away. I mean, even though, like, you have RBI has put in some sort of retail secondary platforms, et cetera, but there's a good chance that even if you hold on to one of these bonds, you're going to hold it to maturity. Like, you're not going to, you're not going to, like, and because, I mean, like, in times like today, where rates are at an all-time high, like, I would ideally love to lock in the yield and then, when rates kind of drop down, take like a 10-year or a 15-year horizon and sell them midway to make a capital gain, which I think, and that becomes even more relevant for the so-called high-yield bond issuances or so-called junk issuances, right? Where, I mean, I think right now, if you even look at it in corporate, I mean, the highest pricing that you might get is 11 to 12%, right? I don't think there's going to be any bond which is going to be trading above that. But do you think, I mean, I agree with you that taxation probably makes it slightly trickier, but there is also, as a customer, right? For example, if today, say, I'm not a large intermediary, I'm like a mid-scale shop or a retail, if I have to say buy XYZ bond, the options are very, very limited for me. I mean, in most of the cases, what I'll end up doing is I'll tap one of those, you know, platforms which have been set up by some merchant bank who is holding or warehousing those bonds on its books and who are just, you know, kind of. So do you think there's also like a, there's some amount of intervention required also in terms of, you know, how to make sure that these instruments actually change hands more easily? I don't know whether technology is the answer to that. I don't know whether regulations is the answer to that.
Yeah, I think the difference, you know, the other aspect is banks price. I think the reason the supply, we were talking about limited supply, and I think the reason that supply is relatively limited, Nikhil, is also because banks in India price risk very differently as compared to maybe what the bond market would price risk at, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because let's take, for example, banks in India are relatively more liquidity driven. And even a BBB corporate, right, they would probably price at maybe 12 or 13% and give them a working capital line, right?
Yeah.
Now, the key question is that today, you know, would an investor, you know, who's participating in the bond market really price risk in the same manner, right? And the answer to that would most likely be no. So I think if you look at both these two aspects that I'm speaking about, right, number one is the way banks are pricing risk, you know, vis-a-vis the bond market, at least in India, is very different. I think that gap needs to narrow down. And I think the second is, a sort of tax, right? You know, certain tax incentives coming through. See, both of them sort of related because automatically the tax rebates on a post-tax basis, investors' expectation on the yield, you know, sort of comes off.
Yeah,
it's circular. There's some
It's circular. So at least my sense is that I think if you have both of these getting resolved, I think you'll have more supply coming in. You'll automatically have a robust secondary market, you know, where the trading activity will significantly increase. To my mind, if you don't plug both these gaps, whatever measures you might take, I just don't see, bond markets deepening personally.
Is one issue also that banks are, for example, in the Western construct, I mean, I'm not saying that's a correct construct, but what one sees there often is that when it comes to long-dated funding, banks take the back seat. And usually, marketable securities take the lead. Whereas in India, I mean, and in India, that's the problem, right? I mean, it has also caused a lot of asset liability mismatch with a lot of banking institutions, right? You're actually matching depositor money with long-dated assets. Doesn't really... And to be fair, if you ask me if a public sector bank is well-equipped to underwrite corporate, probably not, right? I mean, so, I mean, maybe that's also a problem, right? That the supply is skewed because banks are pricing depositor-driven funds, putting a small premium on it, and then lending it to corporates. Corporates find it way more lucrative than actually issuing bonds.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's the point, right, where banks are pricing risk very differently compared to how investors are pricing risk, right, in the bond market.
Yeah.
Banks, I mean, still today, if you're, let's take for example, you know, an investment-grade borrower, you know, maybe at, BBB rating or, you know, maybe early A-category rating, I think the way the bond market would price you would be substantively higher as compared to the price that the bank market would essentially give you, right?
Yeah.
And how do you, and my key question becomes, how do you plug that gap, right? Because I think banks will continue to keep lending at the rates that they're lending, right? To sort of start asking banks, okay, you increase the rate, that you're giving borrowers becomes difficult and not prudent for the economy most certainly. The only other way is to sort of give some tax incentive, right? So that at least on a post-tax basis, that sort of risk or that spread comes down.
Yeah. It's you know, the reason this is of interest and much more recent interest is, I mean, we manage a prop book ourselves, and one of the activities that Nikhil and I do is sort of get into detailed discussions with each other on how to allocate, right? And one of the things that we've consciously sort of pushed around is to increase our exposure to bonds a little bit in the last, let's call it 6 months. And it's not easy to get corporate bonds. It's not easy to get GSEC bonds also. Like, it's the entire value chain is not very easy in terms of discovery and closing. I mean, I remember like how painful it was, right? And even some state government bonds, like it's just a market that so far behind, like there's just so much that needs to be done to sort of...
It's because supply has been always limited because of the demand mismatch, right? Because of the pricing mismatch. So I think that's why I'm saying that the secondary market deepening, right, Sharad, becomes a function of really the primary market deepening. And I think that's my key point. I completely agree that today there's no volume available, you know, the secondary market even if you want to go and buy. But why is that, right? Because ultimately supply itself is very limited. And my whole point is that why is that supply limited, right? Because of sort of the tax structure, and because of the way credit is mispriced by banks vis-a-vis the INR NCD market or the bond market. And I think the moment you have these two fixed, you'll have a lot more issuances coming out of the primary market, and then that will automatically increase a lot of supply available in the secondary market, either in the form of fractional or direct trading block. Because today what happens is that who is it that can absorb all the supply? It's primarily mutual funds, pension funds, insurance companies, right? Yeah. These are the ones who typically absorb it. Mutual funds usually have a three-year paper. They prefer subscribing to three-year paper, and then they do buy and hold rather than looking at churning, right?
Yeah.
The key guys who would ultimately, be participating in the secondary market would be your family offices, your domestic investors, maybe certain more international investors, individual investors, retail, right? And for them, you need to make bonds attractive as an asset class, which today, as an asset class itself, it's not attractive.
No, makes sense. And fair enough.
I think that's the key point. My simple question becomes, maybe for 150 basis points of additional return on a post-tax basis, would an investor or a retail investor prefer putting money into a local bank FD, like an SBI maybe? Or would they prefer subscribing to, A-plus credit of a borrower for just that 150 basis points additional delta on a post-tax basis, right? And I think that 150 basis point delta doesn't become, interesting enough and enticing enough, for a domestic investor to participate to take that level of additional risk.
It makes sense. And fascinating chat. I mean, we started talking about what you're seeing in the VC ecosystem, and we moved and we're ending the discussion on liquidity and the challenges in the corporate bond market and how loose it is. It was a thoroughly enjoyable chat though.
I think one thing probably wanted to ask you a bit about is about A-Rays, which I guess is your platform, right? Which looks at matching Series A, Series B, stage companies with the right set of investors. First of all, I would love to hear a bit about the mechanics there. I mean, is it like a technology platform of sorts, or is it more about, manually curating transactions and kind of piggybacking on your existing relationships? And secondly, very fascinated to also hear about your thoughts in general about advising early or mid-stage companies, because especially when it comes to tech-enabled businesses, what we often see is that there, when it comes to fundraising activity, it's at least till a certain level, it's often a founder-led story, right? Versus a larger company, which would kind of, piggyback on Corp Dev or Group M&A, etc., and take things forward.
No, absolutely. I think the big perspective on it is, the concept to be conceptualized, where, we wanted to make funding, relatively, quicker and easier, for startup founders. I think the biggest challenge for most, founders are looking to raise a Series A round or a Series B round really becomes the ability to you know, get investors onto a common platform and talk about their story. So I think Aries was really conceptualized with the objective of, you know, putting investors into a room and really having startup founders talk about their actual businesses. I think there were a lot of networking events which we realized. Right. But we wanted to set up a more formal platform where founders can come and sort of talk about their businesses. They get you know, some time to explain their businesses' key matrices. And then sort of whichever investors you know, have interest in those relevant businesses, you know, they can connect subsequently right. with the startup founders, you know, to understand their story and matrices better. So I think that was sort of the overall objective of Aries. And yeah, I think on the second part, pertaining to early to mid-stage.
No, yeah. So I was saying early to mid-stage companies, typically they're founder-led when it comes to fundraising, right? So, I mean, how does an advisory kind of a construct sit into that?
See, I think what typically happens is, you know, when a founder, yes, a lot of early stage companies, I think, are of course founder-backed and totally, you know, TAM-backed, right? As far as the VC ecosystem is concerned. But I think typically when a founder is looking to raise his first serious round of capital, you know, that's the time he needs the most amount of guidance and most amount of assistance, right? Because we've really seen founders at times, you know, needing that guidance to find their feet on the ground, right? And actually having a proper formal process being run in order to raise capital. So I think we actually see it as, you know, a very interesting time for founders because this is a period when they don't have their teams fully set up. You know, I think they're expanding their management teams. They're getting in more CXOs or looking to get in more CXOs post the fundraise rather. So I think it's the founder literally having to do everything, right? Run the ops, do the marketing, you know, manage the finances, share data to investors. And then on top of that, if you give them fundraising also, I think a founder has to agree not to sleep, you know, at night if he wants to, you know, continue to grow the business. So I think that's where we come in, you know, when we say that, you know, look, we'll assist you with everything.
Perfect. No, thanks. Thanks for the chat, Shivam. Hope you, hope this was a good end to your Friday. I don't know whether it's still end of your Friday or you're going to continue working. And no, absolute pleasure. I will obviously keep in touch. And it was, you know, what happens is that I think credit is something that we you can have at least two or three different shows exclusively focus on that asset class. Probably only three or four people will listen in, so I think we'll avoid it. But it's something which we personally find super fascinating. So it was good to get your insights on it.
So thanks. Thank you, Sharad, for having you know, me on, and you know, look forward to being in touch. Thank you, guys.
Perfect. So with that, this is Nikhil Arora. I have with me Sharad Tupran signing off.